It is time for another edition of The Bandwagon, the first episode of 2016. The Bandwagon, not your typical sports podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
And I'm Lisa Baltz.
2016 is here, Lisa.
It's here.
Students are back this week.
It's here, and I feel like a bear coming out of its cave and stretching.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's, as we're speaking, it may have made it out of the single digits already. I'm not sure.
Up to 12. All the way up
what?
To 12.
Yeah. Yes. Spring is on the way.
Yes, it's closer than we think. So
right.
Bandwagon time, and in the last few weeks since we've talked with you here on the podcast, certainly a lot of sports things happening. We could start in a lot of different places, but the one that's on my mind, Lisa, is the relocation of the St. Louis Rams to Los Angeles, kind of going back to where they were 20 years ago. It just kind of brings up the whole topic of, you know, teams relocating and the impact it has on the cities on both ends of the relocation. There's a lot of aspects to it, and I guess I'll start with this. I lived in St. Louis for a couple of years right out of college. I was there when the Rams won the Super Bowl. So that was probably the closest thing that St. Louis ever really had to Rams fever when I was, you know, when I was living there, or from mm-hmm. what I can gather from my friends, really the closest thing they've had to it ever since.
Wait, what year was that? Sorry.
That was the Super Bowl... 99, I believe, was the 98 season, the 99 Super Bowl. That's when it was.
Okay.
I remember having a little gathering, watching it. I had a friend with at that time, a big screen projector. So he brought over his projector screen and we watched it on the big screen that way. And it was fun. And I remember, you know, the city getting caught up in it, as you would expect. For a city that had never seen a Super Bowl team, going back to when the Cardinals were there. But I still had this feeling that St. Louis was never going to be a Rams town just because of kind of the nature of the city. The Cardinals are so prominent there that the Rams were always overshadowed until the Cardinals season was done, whether that be at the end of September or at the end of the playoff run that they usually seem to have. And St. Louis is also a pretty good hockey town. The St. Louis Blues have a very strong following there, too.
Yeah.
So I always got the impression, at least when I was there, that Rams were kind of the third fiddle. But in kind of seeing some of the chatter on social media about it, Lisa, I think the group of people that I really legitimately feel bad for in all of this, and not to sound cliche, but the kids, because you've got kids who are football fans in that area.
Yeah.
And as they're growing up, that's their team. That's their football team. And now that team is moving 2,500 miles away. And basically, if you're a kid, you have a choice. Do you keep rooting for the team that left town, or do you just pick another team kind of randomly and start rooting for them?
Well, I think the whole idea of teams relocating, just deciding, you know what? We're moving on. We're gonna go somewhere else. Or in the case of the Rams, we're gonna go back. So like I have never been able to reconcile the fact that the St. Louis team was ever called the Rams. Mm-hmm. It sounded so dumb to me.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother in the 70s was a fan of the Rams. I can't remember which player. The Los Angeles Rams. I remember his little jersey that he got for Christmas one year, probably 1978 or something. And so it's always just, it seemed weird to me. Now, the idea of teams moving around is not new by any stretch. I mean, the Dodgers haven't always been in L.A., folks.
They were the trolley Dodgers in Brooklyn.
Exactly. So, and myriad other teams. I mean, the Los Angeles Lakers. There's no lakes in Los Angeles. I mean, there are maybe, but they came from Minnesota years and years and years ago. I mean, I remember being stunned when I learned that, by the way. But anyway, so the idea of teams moving around is not a foreign one. I can't profess to know, like, in past. It just seems to be happening more, and it's more driven by money. And I'm sure it was always driven by money, but now it just seems like there's so much more money to be made.
Yeah, and I think it's degrees. Like, for instance, there are always changing demographics in the country. You know, for instance, when the Dodgers and Giants moved from the East Coast to the West Coast, there were no major pro sports teams in California on the West Coast.
It was like pioneering.
Yeah, and California was growing so much World War II that it seemed like a natural fit for teams to go out there. Now, you know, you could argue, well, maybe it should have been an expansion team that went out there instead of teams moving or whatever else the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always been that type of thing. It seems to me like now it's really a case of degree. I don't think you can make the argument that the Rams were not profitable in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before I think you could find legitimate circumstances where teams were actually losing money in their current city for whatever reason, you know, lack of attendance, et cetera, et cetera. Especially when I think back to maybe some of the teams, you know, in the NBA when it was struggling, like in the 60s and 70s, it seemed like teams were moving all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, Buffalo, Braves moving down to Atlanta and becoming the Hawks and, you
right.
know, all sorts of different things like that where they just weren't making any money. Now it seems like it's a question of degree. You know, Stan Kroenke, the owner of the Rams, saw some big-time dollar signs with the stadium deal that he put together in Inglewood, California. And certainly not a coincidence that Kroenke putting together that stadium deal as the owner of the Rams, and then
right.
this gets approved.
Right. Yeah. And going back for a second about what you said about the kids. I mean, I think back in the day when the Dodgers moved or when these baseball teams were moving, I mean, you know, a lot of kids loved baseball and would have to figure out ways to transfer their loyalties. It's not like they were going to start liking the Yankees or something.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they would just be, they could still be fans, but there's not, but it's like losing that sense of place.
Yeah.
You know, and especially in St. Louis now where there's, I don't know, are there any plans to bring another football team in? I mean, they have a stadium that's going to be sitting there. Is their stadium a multi-use stadium?
Yeah, it's the Edward Jones Dome, and it can be used for some other things, but mostly like conventions and things like that.
So it's not, but it's not what I meant was it's not being used as a stadium for another team right now, like baseball or anybody like
no,
that.
No, no. Okay. I mean, the Cardinals have their own place. The St. Louis Blues have their own arena. Yeah, there's really no major sports team that will be using the Edwards Jones Dome that I know of. There's been talk of St. Louis possibly trying to bring in a Major League Soccer franchise
mm-hmm. I've heard that.
To town. And I think that could be a good fit for the market, but the talk there, I think, is you know putting together some sort of a deal for that team to have its own stadium
oh,
as
sure.
well.
Everybody's got to have their own now.
Yeah, it's interesting how that's come full circle.
Isn't that weird? Because I noticed this the last time I was in Minneapolis. So when I lived in Minneapolis, St. Paul in the 80s, there at one time was the Met Stadium, which was an outdoor stadium. Like, so when you'd see Fran Tarkenton playing in the snow, like when he was the Vikings quarterback, that's where they were playing. The Twins also played there. And then on the same patch of land, there was the Minnesota North Stars arena. Mm-hmm. And then like the year after we moved there, they moved the football and baseball teams to the Metrodome, mm-hmm. which they had just built downtown, which even in the year before it was fully open for operation, there was so much snow that fell in 2 days, like 40 inches of snow over a weekend or something, that it deflated the dome. And everybody called it the dish, I remember. And being from Florida, we just thought it was so funny, but it was actually quite a disaster. But anyway, and then the North Stars eventually moved as well, and that site was used for the Mall of America.
Oh, okay.
So, and now, but anyway, it was like, okay, the dome is going to, we're going to be able to play basketball in here when the NCAA tournament comes through, because in the 80s there was no
mm-hmm.
Basketball stadium or basketball team. And we're going to be able to have football, and the Minnesota Gophers, the University of Minnesota's football team, is going to play in here too, and the Twins. And it was just like this multi-use. It was ugly, but it was where everybody played. And so now you fast forward 25 years, and the dome has been torn down, which to me is just like, I can't even imagine Minneapolis, St. Paul without it. I mean, but now you have to. The Target Center went up in, I think, 1990 or 91 when the Timberwolves came to town. That's a basketball stadium right downtown, and also concerts and stuff there
mm-hmm.
too. It was open when I lived there. And then, but now there's like a professional baseball field, and then the Gophers have their own football stadium, and now there's a new football stadium being built for the Vikings, which is, I have to tell you, the Metrodome was ugly, but this is like even worse. And it's all made of glass,
mm-hmm.
the outside, and it's really angered the bird people.
Oh, yeah.
In Minneapolis, St. Paul, because the birds keep crashing into it. And so, you know, I don't have. But anyway, so yes, we've come from this place of where you have these multi-use, multi-purpose stadiums in downtowns where there's already foot traffic and things to do. And now you have everybody's got to have their own arena. And Minnesota's going to have their own MLS team, soccer team. And they are negotiating right now to build a brand new soccer stadium because it's pretty specific. It's going to be a little smaller. It's not going to seat 60,000 people. It's going to seat maybe 25. And it's going to be in St. Paul. And there's already a baseball stadium in St. Paul for their minor league team or whatever they've got over there. So there's just stadiums everywhere. And Minneapolis-St. Paul is not unique in any way. There's stadium deals all over the place. And the implication is, as you were saying, that it's great for economic development. But I think a lot of people would argue.
Yeah, I think the research that I've seen from economists who have studied it have found that the actual amount of growth that comes from building a new stadium is negligible. And basically what you're doing is you're moving dollars around rather than creating new dollars, so to speak. But anyway, that's certainly part of the piece of the puzzle for the Rams moving to Los Angeles. They are departing. They will be playing at the old LA Coliseum for the next few years until their stadium is done. And the LA Coliseum was decrepit 20 years ago.
Yeah. That's another question, and you know, maybe we can talk about this again sometime. But like, what do you do with all these old buildings? Mm-hmm. What do you do? It's just so wasteful. You know, when I look at the U of I and how they could have, you know, really aggressively pursued brand new facilities and for the teams, they decided to do mega upgrades and stay where they were and not tear everything down and start over again, which I think is great. For me, it's a personal preference that you update what you have as much as you can. I realize that sometimes for some types of buildings that ends up costing more money than starting over again. But I actually think in the case of the U of I, I thought the new Memorial Stadium upgrade was pretty good.
Yeah.
Not spent a whole lot of time in there. I have yet to get into the basketball arena. We're going to go watch our team play Iowa here in a couple weeks. But by all accounts, it's pretty cool. So, you know, I don't see anything wrong with upgrading your facilities. I just think it's really strange.
Yeah, if the base of the building is solid, then by all means. And I've been in the new State Farm Center just once. I saw a women's basketball game there, which kind of gave me a little lower key chance just to kind of walk around and take things in. And I was impressed by it. So
cool.
So, yeah. So the Rams are on the move. And some other interesting things that we've got on the agenda here today, Lisa. It isn't often that you see a player in a professional sports league just actively tear down his league. Now, the player did this anonymously.
Anonymous.
Yeah, for NPR. But it was still fascinating nonetheless to see, you know, all these criticisms of the NFL coming from a player who's still active in the league. And, you know, there was some pretty good stuff there, I thought.
Oh, it was. There was a lot of good stuff there. I think if you follow sports at all or have followed the NFL at all, it wasn't like anything shocking or new. But to have a player and have a player in their own voice or in a writing voice from the excerpts I read. And then there was this interview as well. That was what was really surprising to me. I have the page open right now. And also the comments. We'll provide a link to this particular story. But if you're feeling adventurous, you can wade into the comments. And I find the comments almost always are as interesting or even more interesting than the articles themselves because of the types of things people say, none of whom have ever played in the NFL. So there was a lot of like, what is he complaining about? You know, he knew what he was getting into, blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh. And, you know, they get paid so much money that it shouldn't matter and blah, 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 blah. You know, so, and I always want to say, but, you know, you have no, this guy is sharing his experience in the league. It's from what I understood and gathered, it's not like some super giant mega famous guy. It's just a guy who's playing, and you know, this is his career, and he's not going to be a Hall of Famer probably, but I can't remember the last time I've read something like that where a player is talking about is trying to give this almost like ethnographic experience of what it's like to be on a team now, mm-hmm. in this day and age, like the stuff that they're talking about and how some of the guys are, you know, it's sort of like this microcosm of the real world. You know, somebody's acting stupid and most people are just like, oh, geez, you have to, like, nobody's getting into a fight with them about it, but nobody's trying to actively, you know, they're not condoning it. They're just sort of, you know what I mean? And I think that's kind of how humans are. So really it's sort of like this hopped up testosterone fueled microcosm of the real world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's basically the interview came from a book. It's called NFL Confidential, True Confessions from the Gutter of Football. If you're interested in checking out the book, and as Lisa said, we'll have a link to the interview from NPR, and you can find out more information about the book there.
One thing too, yeah, now that I'm looking at this again, it's like so after the whole Ray Rice thing happened, you know, where he was the video, you know, mm-hmm. The domestic abuse case, it was like, okay, NFL's like, okay, we're going to make sure that all these guys have training about domestic violence. And this player's like, and everybody was just like joking around and hanging out on their phone, which, you know, is galling and the nerve of those guys. But then I think of almost every meeting I've ever gone to, you know, and most people are like wishing they were anywhere else. So that, again, that's just sort of another way of saying it's like this crazy little microcosm of the real world, you know, fueled more by money and fame and, you know, wanting to crush the other guy all the time. But they're just like us. They're on their phones. I have to think that most of those guys, rather than not caring, are just really uncomfortable by that subject matter and that.
Yeah, and it's
context.
Interesting. Yeah, they touch on a lot of stuff, you know, in the interview with Audie Cornish, and of course the book itself goes into a lot more as well. But you know, he started talking about one thing that kind of hit me was on meeting players who've been in the league a while, yeah. older players, and just seeing the effects
yes.
that the game has had on those guys who've been playing for 8-10 years. It's pretty amazing. There's a lot of talk right now about head injuries, and that's certainly a big part of it. Mm-hmm. Obviously it is, but it's more than that. When you start having umpteen surgeries for knees and shoulders yeah. and all your joints and muscle tears and everything else, I mean, there are guys who, you know, played in the league for 10 years who, you know, once they retire and they, you know, they just can't get their body right. up to peak condition anymore, they can barely even walk, let alone run around anymore.
Yeah, and it's not like you get up from a chair and you're like, oh, I'm a little stiff. That we're not talking about that kind
right.
of can't walk. We're talking like actually really cannot walk. And he also mentions this like dependence on painkillers mm-hmm. and how every time you get hurt and you know you're down because you tweaked your ankle or your knee or whatever, your first thought is it's over, I'm mm-hmm. done for, that's it, you know. And then when you realize, if you're lucky, you know, that you can still walk on the ankle, then it's like you, I don't know, do you eat all the ibuprofen on the bench and go out and keep going, rub some dirt on it and keep going?
Yeah.
You know, and that in the moment, as a former athlete too, I can totally understand that. But then there's payback. Your body gets exacts its revenge on you later on,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, it'll catch up to you. So anyway, definitely worth checking out the interview and the book itself, NFL Confidential by Johnny Anonymous, which is, I think, a great
Johnny
pen name.
Anonymous.
A great pen
Maybe
name.
Maybe that's going to be my new bandwagon name.
Oh,
I'm going to be Johnny Anonymous.
Johnny Anonymous. All right, I'll have to come up with a good one for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, today, something that I think will be the start of a bit of a series, which should be fun, talking about rivalries
yeah.
in sports. And, you know, we talked about this a little bit off the air beforehand. I think we've all got some ideas of what some future ones might be. But Lisa, you've got the first one, and it is a really good rivalry. It's one that hasn't been in the public consciousness
right.
for a while, but it got brought back up here recently.
Yes. So like if you watch ESPN or you watch, you know, they have their rivalry week for basketball, and there's just always this talk of like teams going head to head, and it's always a bunch of guys and the, you know, led by their coaches, and the fans get into it. We're not going to talk about that today. We're talking about tennis.
Mm-hmm.
And we are not talking about another great tennis rivalry that will be a topic for another day, which is the Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer rivalry, mm-hmm. which was epic, probably like between 5 and 7 years ago, was probably its best.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe, and here's why. So over the break, I was home by myself one day. I'm not sure how that happened. Everybody in my household was somewhere else. And there was nothing, no sports on. So I decided to see what was on HBO, and I ran across this documentary called Fire and Ice.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about John McEnroe and Bjorn Borg. And I'll let you guys figure out who's fire and who's ice.
Boy, I don't know, Lisa.
So of course I'm like, oh, I'm going to watch this. This will be cool. And so the documentary shows them now, which is pretty jarring in a way. I mean, McEnroe still kind of looks like himself, and he's been very much in the public eye as a commentator for tennis. I mean, if you watch any of the Grand Slams, or you know, he's there. He's always, you can always hear his voice, and then his brother, who sounds kind of like him but not exactly, he's also there too. So McEnroe's been around, but it was kind of jarring to see Bjorn Borg, who is now a clothing designer. He has an incredibly well-selling line of underwear.
Oh, hey.
Yeah, in Sweden. So and other things, too. But he got super famous for the underwear. And, you know, he had been having all this financial trouble. Anyway, if you watch the video, you'll see. But anyway, so you don't see him as much. So to see them together, and they have this very poignant shot of the two of them walking out onto the court at Wimbledon, where in 1980 they had this epic, tie-breaky, fierce, like, just crazy match. Just, it was absolutely crazy. And they're back on that court again. And like, both of them are kind of emotional about it. And it was pretty great. But I remember watching that match on television, and my father was just beside himself. He was the whole time, and it went on for like 5 hours. And I remember thinking, like, what sporting event goes on this long? I was probably 11 or 12. And then, and I remember when, spoiler alert, Borg wins. This is from 1980, so, you know, no surprises here. I remember the moment when there's that poster moment where he goes down to his knees, and it's really like that first time in tennis where you see that kind of, where now in the modern day, that sort of celebration, where for Borg it was less like throwing up the racket in the air, and it was just more like falling to his knees and saying yes, because it had been such a crazy match. Now, the two guys had met before,
mm-hmm.
And in fact they met 14 times on the tour, and their victories are split, so one you know, each of them won 7, and they met 22 times in total, 11 and 11.
Yeah.
But they were so different. And the thing that really struck me was, like, they genuinely enjoyed playing against each other.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time. So McEnroe's a little bit younger than Borg. And, you know, he had a little bit of a temper.
Just a touch.
But he would also, like, sort of, instead of directing it when he was younger, instead of directing it outward at the umpires or the line, you know, people, the umpires and stuff like that, he would direct it at himself. And I think after a match where he lost to Borg, and this is in the documentary too, like, Borg kind of said, hey, you know, you got to quit doing that to yourself. Like, almost in a way, like, it's not even any fun playing you because you're beating yourself and I don't get a chance to beat you. And mm-hmm. So then, as you know, over the next couple of years, you know, McEnroe's game is elevating. Borg's game is really great. So Borg wins that Wimbledon, but then McEnroe wins the U.S. Open a few months later. And mm-hmm. then that kind of starts, like, the time of McEnroe dominance. And by 1983, Borg had enough, and he retired. Mm-hmm. And that just, like, wrecked John McEnroe. Just wrecked him. And to hear him talk about it, even now in this documentary, which came out in 2011... He just sounds so lost.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, you know, like, it wasn't even fun for me to play anymore.
Well, yeah, you've hit the pinnacle. You know, you've hit the pinnacle. You've hit the peak. Your goal for how long is to get the better of the best player. You
right.
know, in tennis, it's an individual sport. There's one guy who's at the top most of the time. You've reached that goal, and he retires after you've beaten him a few times. He retires. So what's next? Because you think about tennis at that point in time, that was the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, you know, Jimmy Connors was mm-hmm. kind of McEnroe's contemporary, but he was kind of on his way down at
right.
that time a little bit too.
Right.
He wasn't really at his peak anymore. It was before the young Americans like Agassi and Sampras came on the scene in the late 80s, early 90s. So it was before that. So they're really... I mean, there were some great players around the world.
Oh, yeah.
But there just wasn't that one player for McEnroe to kind of use as a target anymore.
Right.
It was just a different time.
Right. And I think the contrast in their personalities, too, is really what drove it. I mean, Borg was like, well, kind of like a robot out there sometimes. You very rarely saw anything from him. Like, you know, apparently, though, I did not know this until I watched the documentary. He was a bit of a hothead himself on the junior circuit in Sweden. And then all of a sudden he had a coach or some sort of mentor who told him, you need to knock it off. And then that's when, like, the curtain fell.
Yeah.
On his face, like, in terms of expression, like, just... That was it. And so nobody ever really knew what he was thinking after he missed a shot, except, you know, you would see that emotion maybe at the end of a match. And so especially a big match like the one where he beat McEnroe at Wimbledon. Whereas McEnroe, you know, everybody has this idea of him wearing his headband with his foofy hair and his hands on his hips, holding his racket, yelling,
"You cannot be serious!"
Yeah, you cannot be serious, and among other things, or just hitting the net with his racket, or throwing his racket, or, you know, just basically having a tantrum on the court. And so I think that contrast in their personalities is something that really made it fun to watch, and also fun for the two of them to play against each other. And they have played against each other in exhibition matches and charity matches. Even to this day, they both still get together and play. Mm-hmm. You know, but there is really nothing like watching them play tennis against each other. And you can find videos online of them doing this. But I will say, if you're used to watching tennis being played the way it is now, you're going to be looking at these guys like, what on earth are they doing? You know, it's a completely different game.
Wooden rackets. The biggest difference. And then, yeah, the equipment. And, you know, as in every sport, I think guys have developed much more physically, weight training and everything else. Not that McEnroe and Borg weren't great athletes. They were. But when you just think of the weight training and the other things that are going on now in sports that weren't back in the late 70s and early 80s, it's just a big difference.
You might have been able to see Borg's abs if they had been made visible. I doubt you would have been able to see McEnroe's. I mean, the type of fitness that was needed for that particular game of tennis, I think it really started to rise more as you got into, like, Boris Becker and the Swedish Dream Team and all those guys it was a different type of fitness, to be sure. But, and in terms of other tennis rivalries, you know, in the women's game, during that same time, you had the Chris Evert Lloyd back then and Martina Navratilova rivalry kind of heating up. Totally different kind of thing, I think, there, too. There seemed to be more focus on each of their personal lives, too. And, like, Martina was from Eastern Europe, and Chrissy, who's still also commentating on tennis television, you know. So that, there was not so much made of that rivalry. And again, you could argue that the Agassi-Sampras rivalry but I just found tennis from that era so bloody boring. You know, I didn't really get back into it again until Nadal and Federer. And there are a lot of women right now playing tennis who are amazing. And I'm not just talking about Serena Williams.
Yeah, there are a lot of very good women playing right now. So that's the start of what we hope will be a series talking about great rivalries in sports. And there's so many that we can touch on this, and
just so people know, I mean, it can be teams, it can be coaches, it can be cities, it can be mascots, it can be anything. So I, for one, am anxious to see what Brian brings to the table next week.
Yep, it's my turn.
In the next couple of weeks.
It's my turn, so I look forward to bringing a good one to the table. So be sure to join us for that as we wrap up this edition of The Bandwagon.
Yes, it's my turn now. I'm going to read to you guys.
Yay.
Thank you for joining us today on The Bandwagon, where we're always going to remind you there is plenty of room for everyone. Bandwagon is produced by the two of us, Lee Spraltz and Brian Moline. Brian does the vast majority of the heavy lifting, too. He's the studio engineer and the editor. You're the boss. He sounds so important, I have written down here.
But I'm not.
Scott Cameron is WILL's Director of News and Public Affairs. Big ups to him and the Will Newsroom for their support and tolerance. If you see funny pictures of me and Brian on the WILL website, chances are very good they were taken by Mike Thomas.
Yes.
not the former U of I athletic director, but Illinois Public Media's art director. Our theme song is by one of my favorite bands from Athens, Georgia, REM. Thanks to Jim Kelly for the suggestion. You can locate past episodes of Bandwagon at will.illinois.edu, as well as links to the articles we discussed and some basic show notes. We'd love your feedback via email, or if you'd prefer to start a conversation online, go ahead and ping us on Twitter at
BMoline, W-I-L-L.
And or at Lisa Braltz. In the meantime, we'll just be over here watching some sports ball and getting ready for the next episode coming your way the week of February 8th. Thanks for listening.
Ta-ta for now.